Okay, part two. Welcome to historical sketches or history of Rishonim and Achronim. Today we're doing the Rambam, 1138 to 1204. That makes him more or less 100 years after Rashi. Now let's be clear, in between Rashi and the Rambam, we could talk about the Baalei HaTosfos, who filled that gap, and maybe one day we will, but the Baalei HaTosfos is, it's a lot of people. So it's harder to present. If you had to guess, you'd say Rabbeinu Tam was the most important of the Baalei HaTosfos, but we're going to the Rambam. Everybody knows the Rambam. So how do we start? I'll start as follows. Maybe 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, the New York Times had an article, and some interesting article on the cover of the New York Times Sunday edition, about a horse named Maimonides. And the whole point of the article was these people, these Arabs, this guy Ahmed Zayat, this Arab guy bought a horse and paid a lot of money and one day he'll win the Triple Crown, and he wants to be Makarev, Muslims and Jews, so he named it Maimonides. So just to be clear, Ahmed Zayat, his real name is Ephraim Zayat, he's a frum Jew, lives in Teaneck. The Times blew the story completely, but it doesn't matter. The point is, there's a Maimonides who's beloved outside of base medrashes and outside of Orthodox Judaism and outside of Judaism at all. That's not the Maimonides we're going to talk about today. But you should just know, he's wildly revered, in the Muslim world, in Spain, for all the other things he did. That's not what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the Rambam who wrote essentially three of the most important works, in the history of Judaism. The first is the Perash HaMishnayos. The second is the Sefer HaMitzvos, and the third is Mishneh Torah, Yad HaChazaka. Okay, that's what we'll focus on. Just a word about the Rambam. Again, there are people who are famous in their lifetimes and then kind of fade away. There are people who weren't that famous in their lifetimes, but after death, they become really, really famous. And then there's the Rambam, who was the Rambam in his day. You should understand that. Like, it wasn't that later on people realized, oh, this is the Rambam. When the Rambam lived in Egypt, he was the Gadol Hador. They said Mishaberach with his name, there were tfilos about him and with him. He was the Rambam in his life, and then either he became as popular or more popular as time went on. Okay, but we know a lot about the Rambam's life because, again, he was the Rambam from an early age. First of all, his father was an important Jew, right? Maimon, his name, was a Dayan in Spain. The Rambam was born in Cordova, Spain, in 1138. And so a lot was expected of him as the son of a Dayan. Legend has it that the Rambam's father, and therefore the Rambam, was a direct descendant of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, which also makes you a direct descendant of David HaMelech. Okay, so, you're important. The Rambam, the Maimon, the Rambam's father's Rebbe was Yosef ibn Migash, who was a direct Talmud of the Rif. So again, if you're looking at the history of Torah and how it works, the Rif was more or less the first Rishon. His Talmud taught the Rambam's father taught the Rambam. When was the Rambam born? What does it mean to be born in Spain in Cordoba in 1138? Well, it's good for a few minutes, but then it gets really bad. Okay? It's the end of what people refer to as the Golden Age of Spain, where Jews lived with the protection of the Muslims who ran the place. Jews had what's called a dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I status. That's like, in the law, you're a second-class citizen, and you have to pay some special tax and what have you, but you're protected. You could be frum, you could learn, you could daven, you can live an open life as a Jew. There's a flourishing Jewish community. Okay, you're a second-class citizen, for whatever purpose that means. Muslims are more important than you. But there wasn't that much anti-Semitism at the time, and the Jewish community flourished. The problem is that ended when the Rambam was a little kid. Okay, the Almohades conquered Cordova, and they abolished the status, this dhimmi status. What does that leave you with? Basically, two choices, convert or get dead. Okay, those are the only two choices you have. You could fake certain things, or you could leave. That's what Maimon decided. The Rambam's father said, we got to leave. The problem was, at that time, it's really hard to find a place to go where you could be openly Jewish and you can be part of a community. And more or less, they spent 10 years traveling around Spain. They made it to Fez. They made it to all different places. No place was welcoming enough where they felt like the family could grow and live. So the Rambam spent his teenage years into his 20s basically traveling around on boats and hiding and doing all these different things and running away from different people and different persecutions. You'd think that, you know, he didn't have time for much else. But as we're about to see, the Rambam's capacity for writing and learning and producing is like staggering beyond anything any of us could ever imagine. The Rambam started writing his Perush HaMishnayos as a teenager. Huh?
Wasn't he
17? 17 a teenager?
Yeah.
Okay. So all the dates are exact, you know, it's hard to know exactly. But the Rambam started writing the Perush HaMishnayos as a teenager. It may have taken him 8 years. It may have taken him 10 years. Almost all of that time, the Rambam describes, he wrote stuff in a cave. He wrote stuff on a boat. He wrote, you know, it's unbelievable he was able to do it. But the Rambam, probably by the time he was 28, give or take a year or two in either direction, published the Perush HaMishnayos. If the Rambam wrote nothing other than the Perush HaMishnayos, he would have been the Rambam. It was that staggering a work. It was that important. A, it's every Mishnah and the halachic result. But the hakdamos to the Perush HaMishnayos were much bigger than the actual Perush HaMishnayos in terms of the Rambam's impact on the world. The first thing is the Rambam wrote it in like a fake language, right? The Rambam used Hebrew letters to write in Arabic because the Rambam's writing it for the people who lived around him. So, I don't know, when I was a kid in school, if you didn't want the teacher who wasn't Jewish to understand the notes you were writing to your friends before we had smartphones, you wrote in English but in Hebrew letters, like phonetically. Like I was like Aleph Yud with a patach under the Aleph. You could write that way. That's how the Rambam wrote his Perush HaMishnayos. It limited its impact because you could only read it if you read Arabic. It took 40 years later till it was translated into Hebrew, till it really became a global phenomenon. But that's the first thing the Rambam wrote. Now, we could talk about the Perush HaMishnayos the whole time. Yes?
Is there any significance to the Hebrew translation from that time, or is it just the same as that?
No, it means when you have a problem in the Perush HaMishnayos, it's not clear, because whatever you're reading is a translation.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
for example, that's a safe feminism. There are all, you know, there was the original translation. Rav Kapach, in the last 50 years, wrote one that people think is the best translation.
There's not like one original translation which is considered by far the best.
I think right now people think Rav Kapach's one, which was written again in the 20th century, is the best one. But if it was just as good, it would be just as good. Okay? You're right. You know, when we get to the Mor Nevuchim, that's the same thing. The Rambam didn't write the Mor Nevuchim in Hebrew, which is why if you're going to read the Mor Nevuchim and you don't read Arabic, you might as well read it in English, because the Hebrew is also a translation. Okay? But to get a sense for the Rambam's self-confidence as, you know, in his early 20s, and he doesn't really belong anyplace, the Rambam, the part of the Perush HaMishnayos also had hakdamos, right? So there's the Rambam's history of how Torah Sheba Al Peh developed. There's the hakdama to Pirkei Avos, which is all about ethics. There's the Shmona Parakim. There's the Rambam on Perek Chelek. That's the one that was most famous and got the Rambam the most in trouble. The Rambam decided one day that there ought to be a definition to what it means to be frum. And he made up from scratch this thing called the Ani Mamins. And he said, you either believe these things or you don't go to Olam Haba, right? That's a pretty stark psak, especially when some of these things were believed by Jews. For example, the incorporeality, the Rambam says, if you believe that God has an arm, you know, you don't go to Olam Haba. More or less, the Ravid writes, I believe that God has an arm. The Ravid, a pretty well-known Orthodox Jew. So the Rambam knew what he was doing when he decided these are the rules. And, you know, you can discuss, because it's fascinating, what would have caused the Rambam to start making a definition, you know, of an Orthodox Jew. So almost certainly the answer is persecutions. Almost certainly the answer is people being forced to convert. There's a Shmuel. People claim it's not because the Rambam also was forced to be a fake Muslim for some time. But, you know, if you read the Igeret HaShmad, the Rambam was very supportive of people who converted to Islam and came back. And he thought you could do that to save your life. The Rambam did not think that Islam was Avodah Zarah. They have only one God. He thought Christianity was Avodah Zarah. But again, you feel like the Rambam lived in a world where people were questioning who they were. And people were going to mosques and they had no choice. They're being persecuted. And I think the Rambam said, if you believe these things, you go to Olam Haba. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what they force you to say. If you believe these things. Now, for a different discussion, the Rambam has at least two, maybe three of the Animamas are about prophets, or about Nevuah. One should be enough. It's possible if you live in a world where the Machlokas is Moshe or Muhammad, that's a really, really important thing to put into your Ikre Emunah. So there's not just Ani Ma'amin Shekol Divrei HaNevi'im Emes, which to me seems like enough. There's Ani Ma'amin She Nevuat Moshe Rabbeinu Alav HaShalom Haya Amitit V'Shehu Haya Avla Nevi'im LaKodmin Lefanav LaBa'im Acharav. Moshe was the greatest prophet ever. Is that really necessary? So some scholars claim, well, in a world where you're fighting about Muhammad, so yes, it's really important. But it's not just, I feel like it's an easy question to answer. I'm just struggling with how to answer it. It's true that Christianity values beliefs, you know, above all else, because they don't have mitzvahs the way we do. But God forbid, it's not that we don't have, I don't think there are, let me say this, I don't think
there are, exactly did the Rambam
for no, the Rambam doesn't mean it that way. The Rambam doesn't think that if you're a Michal Shabbos, but you believe that God is incorporeal, that you've got to God, you know, I don't think it works that way. The Rambam's saying, these are the things you need to get in. Now, you have to also do all the things you're supposed to do. But you don't get in if you don't believe in one God. I think the Rambam thought it. I don't care how many times you kept Shabbos and made Kiddush. If you don't believe, if you believe that God can be divided into different beings, you don't get in.
Does he mean getting in like a literal sense?
No, of course not. The Rambam doesn't know what it means any more than you and I do, right? The Rambam famously said, it's a great line, talking about the Yemos HaMashiach, he said, the Ein Adam Sheyodea Ma Sheyihia Ad Sheyihia. He also didn't know what it was going to be. Okay. So that really caused the biggest controversy in the Perash HaMishnayos. Nobody was, you know, cared that much about what he said about Mishnayos. It's all the introductions that really got the Rambam not into trouble, but made it a topic of huge conversation. Okay, the Rambam was, of course, in favor of establishing real standards. As we were persecuted, as people were being killed in massacres and persecuted by Christians and Muslims, I think the Rambam felt like this was a safer way to help us define who we were. Now, the Rambam needs to... Yeah? Okay, maybe. I understand why you're saying it. I don't know if it's exactly, but it's a fair point. Okay, where's the Rambam going to live? So the Rambam travels a lot. He actually gets to Israel before he gets to Egypt. This is something that I'm interested in because I think it's fascinating. In the debate nowadays about whether you can go on the Har HaBayis, so the opponents all say, the Rambam says it's Asur, right? The Rambam does in fact paskins in Isur Kares to go on the Makom HaMikdash. When the Rambam got to Israel, he actually wrote a diary of what he did. And I'll read you a bit of it. Right, got here on a Sunday, the third day of Sivan, traveled around, made it to Akko. Okay. Ubiyom shlishi b'shabbat arba'ayamim liarach mar cheshvan, it's the winter. Yatsanu me'akko la'alot lirushalayim tachat sakana. Okay, any place you traveled then was dangerous. V'nichnasti la'bayit ha'gadol v'ha'kadosh. Okay, so I ask you, just what do you think that v'hispalalti bo biyom chamishi, and on the sixth day, and then yatsati miyushalim lechevron, and we made a yantuf on these days for me and my descendants. What does it mean v'nichnasti labayit hagadol v'hakadosh? So charedim will tell you, yeah, it's like the young Israel of the old city. It's not, you know, it means simple pshat. The Rambam went on the Har Habayis. So for sure he didn't go on the Makom HaMikdash, right? But anybody who tells you that the Rambam thinks it's us to go on Har Habayis, it's not true. The Rambam thinks it's us to go on the Makom HaMikdash. The Har Habayis nowadays is much, much larger than the Makom HaMikdash. I'm not advocating, I'm just saying it's hard not to remember that the Rambam almost certainly went on the Har Habayis when he visited Yerushalayim. Okay. Yes?
So Makom HaMikdash is...
Makom HaMikdash is exactly where the Beis HaMikdash was. There's an Isser Karis for somebody who's Tamei Meis, which would be all of us in this room, to go in the place where the Beis HaMikdash was. But that doesn't cover the entirety of the Har Habayis. The Har Habayis is huge. Is that not clear?
No, I get it.
It's like the foot, you know, your house covers 50% of the property that your family owns. Right? So it's the same thing on the Har Habayis. Yeah?
What exactly is Makom HaMikdash today? Is there like a...
The scholars tell you what they think. You know, it certainly includes where the mosque is. Right? There's no doubt about that. Okay, let's go on. The Rambam then moves from Israel, where he really didn't stay that long, first to Alexandria, a really big city in Egypt, then to a smaller city named Fustat, where he basically lived the rest of his life. Basically, in Fustat, there's a nice, comfortable, middle-class Jewish community, and the Rambam takes over there. But shortly after he arrives, the Rambam experiences a terrible tragedy. And this speaks to us, or it ought to speak to us, on any number of levels, including mental illness and the Rambam's resilience. Okay, the Rambam had a younger brother, one brother. His name was David. He was 9 years younger than the Rambam. He was the Rambam's Talmud. They were exceptionally close. Okay? The Rambam did not believe that you could make a living from Torah. He didn't think rabbis should be paid. He was completely against kolels. He never saw a kolel in his life, I'm sure. But he was against it. Okay? How does it work? The Rambam's brother, the Rambam, you know, invested money with his brother, who was in the diamond business. He had the family's whole fortune with him. And his brother traded while the Rambam sat and learned. And that's fine. But on a trip, the Rambam's brother drowned when his boat went down. Okay? Now, what's the Rambam's reaction? So we actually have it. I have it in English. Says the Rambam, listen to this, and it ought to hurt. The greatest misfortune that has befallen me during my entire life, worse than anything else, was the demise of the saint, may his memory be blessed, his brother, who drowned in the Indian Sea, carrying much money belonging to me, to him, and to others, and left me with a little daughter and a widow. The Rambam had to take over for his brother's family. On the day I received the terrible news, I fell ill, and remained in bed for about a year, suffering from a sore boil, fever, and depression, and was almost given up. About 8 years have passed, but I'm still mourning and unable to accept consolation. And then he finishes with the pasuk, Lulei Torascha Sha'ashuai Azavadati Ba'anye. Okay? The Rambam admits to being depressed for up to a year, for being unable to get out of bed. Okay, he lost his brother, lost all his money, had to change his whole life. That's how the Rambam became a doctor. He wasn't planning on being a doctor, but he refused to take money for being a rabbi and for teaching Torah. So he became the world's greatest doctor. When you're the Rambam, you could do that. But that wasn't the dream, right? The idea of, you know, the Rambam believing in Torah, Mada, maybe yes, maybe no. But the Rambam was a doctor b'di'eved. Maybe he also thought it was l'chatchila to cure people, but that wasn't the plan. Okay? Now, when you're the Rambam and you become a doctor, you become the world's greatest doctor, and then you get to be the doctor to the Sultan, to Saladin, and to his whole harem, and to his whole court, and it becomes a really, really big job. Okay? It took up a massive amount of the Rambam's time. It's hard for me to overemphasize this point of how busy the Rambam was, and yet what the Rambam was able to produce. It's really staggering. Here's a good example. The Rambam wrote his own Sefer Torah. Now, I don't care if he's the fastest sofer in the world. That's a lot of time. Why did the Rambam write his own Sefer Torah? Nothing fancy. Because it's a mitzvah. And now let me make another point that I think is important. We think of the Rambam as being like the super intellect, which is, of course, true. But the Rambam was a super frum person. The Rambam loved HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a mitzvah. I'm the Gadol Hador, I'm busy, I have no time to do this, I know all the Heterim. No, the Rambam sat and took the time to write his own Sefer Torah because it's a mitzvah. Not because he's the Rambam, and not because he's a genius, because frum people keep the Torah. The Rambam was, it's hard to convince you, the Rambam was as frum a person as there was in the world. He loved God, I'll show you other things. He's not just the brain. Of course he was the greatest brain of his time and maybe ever, but that's not what made him who he was. The Rambam worked really hard. He answered questions, he gave shiurim, he led his community. The Rambam has a letter in which he describes his day. And he says he gets up in the morning, he davens, he learns, then he has to leave immediately on his mule to go to the palace to take care of whoever may be sick there. And he says he's there at least half the day. He has no time to eat because he's so busy doing this. Depending on if other people are sick, he may spend more time there. He says by the time he gets home, he's exhausted. He hasn't yet eaten. He's basically fasted till he gets home. He says, but by the time I get home, my ante room is full of people, Jews and Gentiles, waiting for the Rambam to give them advice, to answer questions, to write prescriptions. And he says he sits with them well into the afternoon. He says, I think he just makes them wait a few minutes while he eats something. He sits with them most of the day. You know, essentially, he doesn't get any time till the night. And the Rambam says he has to learn lying down because he's simply too tired to sit up. Because every day is like this, and he describes on Shabbos it's worse. Obviously, Shabbos he doesn't go to the Sultan. He gives a shiur in the morning. The whole community follows him home from shul, right? It's unbelievable how busy he was. And yet, having picked himself up off his depressed bed for a year, having made himself the world's greatest doctor, living with no free time, sleeping a few hours a night, the Rambam decides to write the greatest work ever written by a human being. And that's the Mishneh Torah. And imagine this, because this is how I imagine it. Okay? The Rambam decides not to write halachos that apply to us, like Shulchan Aruch, to write Kol HaTorah Kula in an accessible format to anybody who could read it. So the way I imagine it, you sit down, the Rambam sits down at a table, and in front of him is a blank piece of paper. And he has to, where do you start writing? No one had ever done anything like this before. There had never been a work like the Yah HaZaka. Where do you even start? So it's interesting. What happens is the Rambam realizes he needs a framework within to write. Even the Rambam can't just start writing halachos. He needs a framework. How do you build a framework if you want to write Kol HaTorah Kula? The answer is, first, you decide on a list of 613 doraisas and things that aren't doraisas. So he writes the Sefer HaMitzvos by accident, Ki'ilu. He needed the Sefer HaMitzvos to create the framework in which he could later write the Yad HaChazaka. So he describes that. So the Rambam writes the Sefer HaMitzvos, again, written in Arabic. All machloksim in the Sefer HaMitzvos have to do with translations and what have you. Okay. But the Sefer HaMitzvos becomes, it's a bit of a game because we keep Drabbanans also. So the difference between Doraisa and Drabbanans are less important. But it becomes the framework. You know, if you look at Rambams, and that's really what the Yad HaChazaka became. It's the Rambams categories that changed learning forever. The categories never existed before. Okay? Yad HaChazaka, why? It has 14 books. And each book has within it, you know, smaller books. I don't know what you would call them. Huh? This must be a word for it. I'm saying, duas, within nashim, right? So what are we going to use most year learning? Subas, nashim. So the Rambam decides there's a big book called nashim. What's within nashim? Ishus comes first. Then, gerishin, Yibum and Chalitza, a thing called Nara Basula, which is only three prakim long, and Sota. So the categories become, you know, why do briskers love Rambam so much? Because they're in categories. You ask yourself a question, why did the Rambam put this here and not there? Why did the Rambam put it, a good example, Ishus. So I think to myself, well, Ishus, why didn't you just write Kiddushin? The next one is Gerushin. So the answer is no, because Ishus encompasses much, much more than just getting married. It encompasses all the rules of period virivia, sher ksus va'ona, things like that. So it's much broader. But the Rambam had to sit down and create these categories. They had never existed before. And they became the way that people learned Torah and the way that people, you know, played with lamdos. It's a strange thing. It's obvious to me that the Yad HaChassidut, first of all, the Rambam named it Mishneh Torah, which people thought was a little arrogant, right? Because it sounds like, you know, also the Rambam in his introduction very famously wrote, after my Sefer, you'll only need a Tanakh and my Sefer, right? So Rav Salvation wants to point out, he thinks that's why we call it the Yad HaChassidut, because Mishneh Torah seems like a lot. The Shalah wrote a Sefer called Shnei Luchot HaBrit, but everybody calls it the Shalah. This is a lot. Shnei Luchot HaBrit, who are you? Okay? So, but the categories were enormous. And here's what's interesting. The Rambam wrote his Sefer Halacha. The Rambam thought this is Sefer Halacha. I say this with great respect. It failed on that level, meaning it's not the Sefer Halacha. People don't learn Rambam nowadays, except for Nevo, right? People don't learn Rambam nowadays. That's true, right? You guys passed him like the Rambam.
Yeah.
Very few Jews now pass like, obviously his impact is enormous. But it didn't succeed as a Sefer Halacha, but it succeeded as the most important book ever written by a Jew and maybe ever written in the world. Because you can't learn without relating to how the Rambam categorized things. Okay. Why does that matter for us? So I'll tell you this because you're at the beginning of your journey to becoming Talmidei Chachamim. The key to remembering anything and learning is having categories in your head. Okay? When I was a kid, my best friend was this guy, Aaron Dicker, whose father taught in the Masifta of Long Beach. He remembered all kinds of like learning things, and I remembered all kinds of sports things. All kinds of sports things. And at some point, I figured out how it works. Why am I so good at remembering sports things? So first, sad to say, because I really cared a lot about sports. But second, I had created categories in my mind for storing information. The second something came across my mind, okay, I had a category for football, for baseball, for basketball, for, you know, and then like miscellaneous stuff. And then you do it by teams, and then you do it by positions, and then the stuff is easy to recall. The Rambam created a system in which, and now you guys have to start using it, where when you come across a halacha, when you come across an idea, you have to put it in your brains in a file. You have to create a filing system. It can't just be, you know, it's easy to remember Dvar Torah, because whether you thought about it or not, Divrei Torah exist in your head by Sefer, then Parsha, then ideas. We all create systems of remembering things for the stuff we're familiar with. The Rambam did that with Kol HaTorah Kula. Okay, what's the reaction to the Yad HaChazaka? So on the one hand, it cemented the Rambam as the Gadol Hador, right? It was so staggering, you couldn't, you know, no one else could, what could you say or do about it? But a lot of people were angry at the Rambam for the following reasons. One, what an arrogant guy, God forbid, you know, he thinks he's replacing Gemara. So first thing you should know is that there weren't a lot of people learning Gemara, right? To us it sounds unbelievable. The Rambam wanted to replace the Gemara, so he didn't want to replace the Gemara, but even if he did, in Egypt, no one had a shas. People weren't sitting around learning Daf Yomi. So it's not as bad as it sounds. Okay? The real challenge to the Rambam was, who is the Rambam? He doesn't give us any sources. He doesn't give us any support. He doesn't tell us why he paskins a certain way. He just paskins a certain way. Again, for the Rambam, it was like, okay, that's what the world needs. The world needs a sefer that gives you the bottom line. But people didn't like it. Okay, the Rambam paskined against certain accepted positions, which people didn't like. The Rambam included Aristotelian philosophy, which people really didn't like. But the main thing, the main challenge, and this is where the world changed when the Rambam wrote the Yad HaChazaka, was this is going to be the end of learning. Right? Why would anybody learn anymore? The Rambam is just giving us the answer. It'll stifle creativity. Right? Of course, the opposite happened. Right? The Rambam created creativity and learning because of how he did it. But that was the challenge. You have to understand how revolutionary the Yad HaChazaka was. It's not that it was the most comprehensive or best halacha sefer written to date. It was the only halacha sefer written to date. Nobody had ever thought to do such a thing, or nobody had the self-confidence. The Rambam changed the world. Since the Rambam wrote the Yad HaChazaka, every single halachic work is a response to that. What do I mean? Well, the Beis Yosef said, there's not enough information in the Rambam, I'll give you all the background. right? Then the Beis Yosef realized he gave us too much background. So he made the Shulchan Aruch, which was smaller. Everything after the Rambam is just an expansion or a contraction on what the Rambam did. The Rambam gave you the bottom line. Since then, all people did was expand on it and contract it and update it. But it is the single most, you know, most important work ever written in Judaism. Okay. Essentially, that's the most important work the Rambam wrote. He's the Gadol Hador. He's under attack, but everything is great. Mor Nevuchim makes his position worse. Okay? The Rambam had a close relationship with somebody named Yosef ben Akin. The Rambam really thought of him or saw him as a son. When he moved away from Fustat, they corresponded. And Yosef wrote him a bunch of questions in philosophy, and the Rambam wrote, that's what I have the English, your absence has prompted me to compose this treatise for you and for those who are like you, however few they may be. That's a big discussion. Okay, who did the Rambam write the Mor Nevuchim for? Because there's certainly stuff in the Mor Nevuchim that... There's stuff in the Mor Nevuchim that you don't find in yeshivas, let's say. Okay, here's an interesting thing. In Frum, if you go to the Mir, you're not going to find a Mor Nevuchim on the shelf. Okay? Now, I used to think it's because they weren't machshavish. They didn't think it was important. Here's what I learned. On the side, I read books. Like, there's a whole subculture of books written by people who went off the derech. Okay, there's a book called, a book written by a guy, Shulam Dean. It's a fantastic writer. It's called All Who Go Do Not Return. Okay, he grew up in New Square. So he tells a story. At some point, he starts doing things that are usher. The Vad Atznius, or whatever it is, the people who run New Square call him in to essentially give him a last chance or to kick him out of the community because he's not living by communal standards. So he tells me, and he writes in the book, that he met with whoever the chairman of the committee is, you know, obviously a Chassidish Gadol, and the guy says to him, I don't understand. Whatever history you know, whatever art you know, whatever music, whatever culture you know, the Rambam knew. And he remained a Frum Jew, so how could you stop being Frum? It turns out that in this world, no one learns the Mor Nevuchim, but it's exceptionally important because it stands for the proposition that you could go into society, you could be a doctor, you could know all these things, but there's nothing out there that's a danger to Torah because the Rambam saw all of it and he wrote this book that I never read, but I know has all the answers in it. Okay, so it's interesting that the Mor Nevuchim exists for Frum people in a way that, like, it's the answer book to all our questions, even though it's very, very hard to learn. Right? The Rambam tried, the goal of Sefer was to try to, you know, reduce conflicts between faith and reason, which the Rambam must have known is completely impossible, and that's what got him in trouble, but the Sefer was important. In terms of, I remember once a guy harassing Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal. The Rambam says this, the Mor Nevuchim says that. And he answered, and this is important, Rav Lichtenstein said, who do you think the Rambam really was? The person who wrote the Yad HaChazaka or the person who wrote the Mor Nevuchim? By which I'm sure Rav Aaron meant, the Rambam was a person who loved God and a Frum person, and he spent his life learning. Yes, he wrote works of philosophy, and he wrote works on medicine, and he wrote, you know, tens and tens of treatises that we've never heard of. But who was he at his core? I often think to myself, and this is just mine, you know, people talk about the Rav Soloveitchik. He wrote amazing philosophic works. But at core, he was a Ben Torah who learned Torah all day and all night. Yes, in his spare time, he wrote staggering works. But when you ask who he was, and I'll finish by reading you one Rambam. It's in Perek Yud Hilchos Tshuva, and I think this tells us who the Rambam really was. The Rambam is describing what it means to love God. He says, what is the ahava ha-ru'uya? How do you love God? Listen to this. Hu she-ye'ehov et Hashem ahava gidola yitera aza ma'od ad she-tehei nafsho kshura ba'avat Hashem. Right? Your soul is bound to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. More. V'nimtza shogeba tamid. And he thinks in his free time, in his spare time, he doesn't surf the internet. He thinks about God. He's connected to God. Listen to this. Ki'ilu chole choli ha'ahava. Like he's lovesick. Yeah, you know, you could stop. He keeps going. She'ein da'ato pinuya me ahavat ota isha, v'hu shogeba tamid. You could feel the Rambam is saying his experience. He's not describing me and you, he's describing himself. He loves God. He's obsessed with God. He's lovesick over God. That's how a person produces what the Rambam produced in his lifetime. He doesn't want to go to sleep because he loves God. V'hu shogeba tamid. Bein b'shivto, bein b'kumo, bein b'sha'ashu, ochel v'shoteh. Yeser mizeh, tiyeh ahavat Hashem b'lev ohavav. More than that, the Rambam says, and I don't know how he knew this, we don't know much about the Rambam's marriage, but it certainly seems like he loved his wife, right? The Rambam says, the person who's lovesick the most in the world, who's obsessed by a woman, more than that, you have to be obsessed by God. I think in the end, the Rambam was, of course, a genius. But his love for God, his commitment to God, his commitment to religion, I think that's what made him the Rambam. And we make a mistake and we sell the Rambam short when we talk about him as just like the smartest guy ever. He was both the smartest guy ever and the most religious guy ever. And it takes both of those to be the Rambam. Okay, Yashkach, have a great day.